study other than the convention, which I consider a bonus. There was some interest in Revelation. I'm always interested in Revelation, so it's a very nice choice for study. We happen to be studying Revelation now in San Diego. We're in the 21st chapter, and I've learned an awful lot through this chapter, through this book, in the recent study. And I've always been interested in the study of Revelation, even when I was a young boy. In the truth, I listened real intently when brethren talked on the subject. But as much as we've looked at it over the years, there have been so many things I didn't know that I learned in the last year or two because of our study in San Diego and some of the email I've had with Sister Jai and other brethren around the country that have been very helpful to me. So this study is going to take more than 2 hours to finish a book like this. And therefore, we'll have to abbreviate the study. But any direction you want to take it, we will go. If you have questions that are any issue that you're particularly concerned with, we'll probably bend the study in that direction as you think where the interest lies. But we have 10 questions on the study outline. These questions form some kind of a basis for proceeding through the book, but there's all kinds of details we didn't put it on the outline that you may be interested in that we didn't think to put down, and if you have an interest in that, just ask and we'll go into that part. I consider this this is a study format, as you know, so I'm expecting your contributions and comments and so forth. Number one, basic outline of the book. What chapters describe the gospel age? What chapters describe the harvest? And what chapters describe the kingdom? That's a pretty general question, but there should be some very specific answers. You know, this starts way back in John's day at the opening of the gospel age. It goes all the way through to the end of the 1,000 years in the little season. So in that spectrum, where do we find the gospel age part? Where's the harvest, where's the kingdom? Jackie? Oh, okay. You had your notepad there. I thought you had an answer there. You're ready to read out.
I just got this out.
Okay, that's right. That's right. And I apologize. If I had this out a week earlier, it would have been more helpful for you. I'm sorry. John?
Just reading from the foreword in the comments, here's a paragraph to start with. It says, the first three chapters refer to 7 different epochs in the church's history.
Okay. That's the 7 churches that go through the age from beginning to end. That's clearly gospel age.
Okay. All the intervening chapters between the 3rd and 20th deal with conflicts between good and evil and evidently cover the entire period of this gospel age. It is the conclusion of this book of symbols from the 18th to 22nd chapters that the close of the gospel age and the inauguration of the millennial age is pictured and the triumph of the Lord and his saints is shown.
Okay. Well, now let's see. If I put gospel here and harvest here and kingdom here, from what you're saying, we should put down 1 through 3 here,
right,
certainly.
Right.
You said 18 and 19 is the judgment which introduced the kingdom. Well, that would be, well, obviously, I think we should put that then as part of the harvest.
Good.
And you said the kingdom. What chapters are the kingdom in?
Twenty through twenty-two.
Right. Okay. Now, there's a whole lot of chapters we didn't list. So, after the 7 churches, what is next in Revelation after the 7 churches?
The throne scene.
And in the throne scene, who's seated on the throne? Chai says God. God himself is seated on this throne. And as John sees all the things around this throne, he focuses his attention on God himself, and God has something in his hand. What is that?
A book.
Give me another name for that, Chai.
Scroll?
A scroll. Okay, it's a scroll rolled up, and it's got something written in it and on it. He can see a little writing on the outside. It's written within and without, is that right? On both sides?
Inside and without.
Okay, all right. Mm-hmm. So he can see there's some writing, but he can't see what's in it. So what's John's reaction?
He wants to know.
That's right. Just like we do. We want to know what's in this book. And so he wept because nobody was worthy to open the scroll. And finally, somebody was found worthy to actually unloose these seals. Jonathan, who was that? Finally found worthy to open these seals.
The Lamb.
Right. That's right. Okay. And so then you have the 7 seals opened one by one by one. So you have the churches here, 1 through 3. You have the seals, That would be, well, I'm going to start with chapter 4, even though you don't really open the seals in chapter 5 and find it 6. And that goes 6 and 7. And then once all the seals are opened, now, let me just roll this scroll up here. I'm going to roll it up backwards, because if it says there was writing on the inside and on the outside, I want to give you the idea that you can see some writing on the outside, that's all. But if I have this seal, if I just have one seal on this scroll, where do you suppose I would put that seal? Right there, in the middle, so you can't open it. Now, if I have two seals, I'd probably space them like that. How many seals do we have on the scroll?
Seven.
So I think there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That would be the logical way. 7, right down. Go ahead.
Could have one on the top and one on the bottom.
Could have one on the top and one on the bottom. Is that what you mean? Like on the edge?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what is a seal that you put on a document to seal it from unopening? Or to keep it? What do you make that seal of?
Wax.
So you heat up the wax and you put a blob on here, and then you take a seal and impress it with something, and you can tell if that's been opened, and it's not going to be open until somebody authorized to open it. Now, if I wanted to put a seal on the edge here,
couldn't do that as well.
It would be very clumsy, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Very odd. I can't imagine putting one on there. Although I have seen pictures of that in various magazines. You know, I think this was from Armstrong Movement produced something like that. And the reason for that, and I've seen other arrangements suggested, is because when you loose each one of these seals in Revelation, starting with chapter 6, what happens each time he looses a seal?
Something's red.
It's more exposed.
Something's exposed.
But something is still bound.
Something's still bound. But you see a vision every time you open something, right? Yeah. Now, here's the question. Is that vision a reading of part of the scroll? If it is, then that would lead you to surmise that there must be somehow an arrangement of these seals so that you can open one and then see a little bit. Open another and see another. But I can't imagine how to do that. So if you have that scroll up here and you put seals on the rim, maybe you could do that, but how do you put a seal on the rim? Now, I've heard another opinion that says, well, this is what you do. You take this scroll like this and you put
seal there.
You put a seal here, you roll it up, and you somehow put another seal there. This is getting pretty messy. I don't really know how to do this. You put a blob of wax here and roll it up, you got ink, you got wax all over the place. I don't think so. I think it's the way we thought originally. You got 7 seals here, and you open one, and you see a vision, but you don't read what's in the scroll yet. You don't read what's inside. Now you notice it never says, you open the first seal and you read a little bit. Never does it say that. It says he opened one and then I saw a vision. Opened another, saw a vision. I think these visions pertain to something that's going to come through the Gospel Age. And we're getting into the thick of something quick, and we haven't even got through our outline yet. But I'll pursue this just a little bit. But Chai, you had a comment.
Okay,
that's your hands up. So if you open all of these, if you open 6 of them, can you read the scroll?
Yeah.
Not really. Not until you open the 7th one. Finally, the scroll unrolls, and now you can read. There's supposed to be something back here, too, on both sides. And I think that the point is that through the seals, you see the things that are going to come during the age that are going to call for God's judgments. But it's not until the 7th one is opened that you see those judgments. And that's what the vision of the trumpets is all about. The consecutive judgments of God blared through the Gospel Age, one after the other, for the various problems that are coming up that the scrolls predict. And we'll get into that more deeply in a while. But the point is you have 7 seals, and then after that you have, therefore, the 7 trumpet blasts of judgment that are... I think the trumpets are really what's written in the scroll. Mm-hmm. And they're trumpeted forward as 7 judgments. And we'll get into that in a little while. But that's chapters 8 through 11. What do we have in chapter 12? That's the end of the seal. That's the end of the trumpets, rather. Now we have 7 churches, 7 seals, 7 trumpets, and that's the end of that. What do we have in chapter 12?
The woman and the dragon.
The woman and the dragon. Mm-hmm. Okay, 12 is that woman. And who does that woman represent?
I forgot. She was pregnant and she gave her birth.
Meryl?
The church?
Yeah.
The church. Right. I think that's a general thought, and I think that's probably the correct thought. As an institution, this is the church. We'll get to that too deeply if we have time. But then in chapter 13, we have something that is not the true church. What do we have there, Chai, in chapter 13?
That's the beast.
The beast. What's the beast?
Is that papacy?
That's the false church then. Mm-hmm. So here we have a picture of the true church and her afflictions, mm-hmm. and now we have a picture of the false church.
Mm-hmm. And the two-horned image. And two-horned beast.
Two-horned beast. So we have, which is another, what is the two-horned beast?
Church of England, Ireland.
Church of England, Ireland. So we've got the nominal systems then in chapter 13. So we've got the nominal. And that's it. Now, chapter 14, what do we have?
Harvest.
The harvest is chapter 14, so I better put that in this column then. So 14 goes over here. What's in chapters 15 and 16?
Plagues.
Seven last plagues. So that all happens during the harvest. That would be 15 and 16. What about chapter 17?
It's the judgment of the whore.
Judgment of the great whore. Now that's got to be during the harvest, because that's 17. We already said 18 and 19 is the harvest. Right. Mm-hmm. So really, we have 15 through 19 is the harvest segment of Revelation. And then, as you all know, that's where Satan is bound for 1,000 years. The church reigns with Christ. New Jerusalem is established, and the kingdom is in chapters 20 through 22. So if you were to write a history prophetically of the gospel age, how would you organize it? Probably you take the first part of the age first, run through the gospel age, and then the harvest, and then the kingdom. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. That's the way Revelation's laid out. Chronologically, there's the gospel age, there's the harvest, and there's the kingdom. Now, when I when I usually write this up this way, I usually draw it this way. There's the gospel age, and there's the kingdom, and where's the harvest? It's back here. Now, I is that right, or should I go this way? Which of those is really the right way to do it? If the three parts of Revelation, the Gospel, verse the chapters 1 through 13, 14 through 19, 20 through 22, those are the three parts. Should they be this way, or should they be this way, or some other way? You know what I mean?
I'm still thinking.
Okay. it's not an obvious question right now, Tricia?
I don't know. Can we yet tell from just blocking out the books of Revelation? I mean, are there no weaving parts of Revelation from one to another?
That's the answer to ask. Are there any interweaving parts? Now, this contains the seven churches. What church are we in today?
Laodicea.
Seventh church, Laodicea. Are we in the harvest today?
Yeah.
Well, then there must be an interweaving between this and the harvest. As a matter of fact, the gospel age really is in seven parts, more equal than I've drawn them.
Yeah.
But this is number seven. The harvest is the seventh phase. So there really is an overlap between the first part of Revelation and the second part. You know, it's kind of like, Revelation gives you this view of the gospel age. Then it backs up and gives you another view. And then it gives you a third wave through the three trumpets. Then it goes, advances the time frame a little bit, but you're still overlapping to some extent. The harvest is really the same as the last phase of the church. Now the big question, and that is, what about that last one? Should that be overlapping like the others are? And you might say, well, I don't know, that depends on this old question about the 1,000 years. And I guess it could depend on that a little bit. But Tricia?
I would think that for me it would maybe depend on if the Lord has returned, because that to me would start a new era. That would link to more than just the gospel.
Okay. So if the harvest begins with the Lord's return, and if this segment begins in its broadest sense with the Lord's return, then we could say that they're synchronous in that respect. Now still, if that's true, that still leaves an open question about the 1,000 years. Is that 1,000 years, or is that 1,000 years? So the fact that we draw it this way does not resolve that question. I think we can resolve that question. We'll see if we get to that or not. I don't know. But that's still an open question. Now, how do we know that all three parts of Revelation actually have something in common? Is there one action that all three parts talk about? Now, specifically, the Lord has returned in phase number 7. How do we know that? That's a common thought. But how do we know that in church number 7, the Lord has returned?
Because of the message to the Church of Laodicea.
What about the message tells us?
Because I stand at the door and knock.
21.
Yeah, you're in the right area. That's it. 20 and 21. Yeah.
20, yeah.
20, would you read that, Anna?
Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and eat with him and he with me.
That sounds good. Probably nobody's going to object to that. But I'm going to ask you to probe a little further. How do we know that means Christ is returned?
Maybe. Gospel of Luke.
Mm-hmm.
And something.
That's the right direction. Yeah. That's where you got to go for it. Yeah. Luke 12, 36. Verse 37. Now, I may have not have that's from memory, so you correct me if I got the right verse. But, Chai, where do you find it?
Yeah.
I don't have the reading glasses, so okay. I see 36, maybe.
Okay, whatever you think is appropriate.
36 and 37.
Okay, Joe, would you like to read that for us?
Both of them?
Yes.
And ye yourselves like unto men that wait for the Lord, when he will return from the wedding, that when he cometh and knocketh, they may open unto him immediately. Blessed are those servants whom the Lord, when he cometh, shall find watching. Verily I say unto you, that he shall gird himself and make them to sit down to meat, and will come forth and serve them.
Okay, so I think it's clear there in the seventh church, in Luke, that his coming, when he finally does come, he's going to knock. That's what it says. Blessed are those who servants who, when he cometh and knocketh, they may open to him immediately. He's knocking. So when you compare that to Revelation 20, I'm knocking now, that means he has come. That's the point. And what does he say he's going to do to the servants when they open to him in Luke? What happens to them?
Sit down to meet.
They sit down to meet. It's a luscious feast of present truth that we have, and we all see that that's why we have the divine plan of the ages today. Now in Revelation 3, does that appear? Does that feast appear anywhere?
Well, vaguely, it says, I will come into him and eat with him and he with me.
There you go. There's that feast. So I think that shows that Luke and Matthew, or Revelation, talking about the same thing. And that, I think, is very strong evidence that Christ has returned by the seventh phase of the church. I think that's very good evidence. Now, in the seventh trumpet, do you find any reference to the resurrection of the sleeping saints? In the seventh trumpet? Rebecca?
Yeah.
This would be in chapter 11, the seventh trumpet. Anything there about the raising of the saints?
Verse 18.
Okay, read the part that you think is appropriate.
And the nations were angry, and the wrath has come, and the time of the dead, they should be judged, and that thou should give us reward unto thy servants, the prophets, and the saints.
Okay. There, the saints are rewarded. Now, if the saints are rewarded under the seventh trumpet, are the saints rewarded before or after Christ returns? Got to be after. If I go away, then I will come back and receive you unto myself. It's got to be after the Lord's return. So clearly in the seventh trumpet, Christ has returned. So both in the seventh church and in the seventh trumpet, we see that Christ has returned to the seventh phase in each case. So I think we're really very sure that the harvest and the gospel age sevens overlap to some extent. Now, here's the big question. Do you find the resurrection of the sleeping saints in anything in chapters 20, 21, and 22? Do you find the raising of the saints in the kingdom chapter?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said, uh-huh.
Plus four.
Who's it? Chai?
Plus four.
Okay, read the part that's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. For the word of God, and which hath not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither hath received his mark upon their forehead or in their hands, and they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years.
Okay. Now that word lived, does anybody have a different rendering for that word lived?
Came to life.
That's the point of Revelation 20, verse 4. Now, I didn't see that for many, many years. I told you we were studying Revelation now? Mm-hmm. It was the last time we studied Revelation. Mm-hmm. I remember it was at the Caravas home, and one of the brethren in the meeting brought this point up. And I had never seen it before. What it's really saying here in Revelation 20, verse 4 is, I saw the souls of them. You know, that's a very odd expression for brethren that know the souls when they die are dead. I saw the souls of them that were beheaded. That's a reference to dead people, dead saints. Just like Revelation chapter 6, under the altar I saw the souls of them. And they were resting yet a little season before their resurrection. That's a way of talking about dead saints. I saw the souls of them, and they came to life. That's the way your version has it. New American Standard?
No.
Is it NIV?
No.
But no. New American Standard?
No, NIV.
NIV. Okay, NIV, New American Standard, it both uses, they came to life. Now, literally, the Greek is rendered well in the King James, they lived. But it's the same Greek that earlier in Revelation says of Jesus, I am he that was dead and lived. Well, the point is, he was dead and he came back to life. That's the point. So lived here means, really, really means they were raised from dead to life. Now, what's the next verse that appears after verse 5, verse 4?
This is the first resurrection.
Take out that spurious part, and he explains what he just saw. He saw the resurrection of the dead in the first resurrection. So the resurrection of the dead is referred to in chapters 20 through 22. So I think that makes a good case that this segment of Revelation and this segment, and by the way, in chapter 14, you know, it talks about, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth, saith the Spirit. They may rest from their labors, but their works well. There's a reference to the raising of the reward of the saints. So in this part, all three of them, we have something that distinctly refers to the raising of the saints. So I think that this is the best option. Tricia?
So you're saying there's chapter 3 then? I think I missed something.
Yes.
Chapter 3, the supping is with the dead saints?
No. I don't think so. You have to have devil's food for that. No, I don't think so. I think that chapter 3 is talking about the feasting with the living saints who receive the Lord at his return.
So where does the raised saints in the...
I think you see that in the seventh trumpet.
And that's in chapter 11.
Chapter 11.
Okay, so if the Lord's return in chapter 3, then chapter 11, and okay.
Yeah. Always the seventh phase, I think, is the Lord's return.
Okay, because chapter 11 is still the gospel.
That's great. That's the point. Yeah, it's still in this gospel age part. So in all three parts, you've got the raising of the saints. So I'm going to be so bold as to erase this option, because I don't think that's really the way Revelation is pictured. But we still haven't solved the question about 1,000 years. It still could be 1,000 years here after the church is complete, or 1,000 years here starting with the Lord's return. We still haven't solved that. So maybe we won't today, but maybe we will. We'll see how far we get. But I just want to show that just overlapping by itself does not settle the question of 1,000 years. That's the only point I'm making here. Yes?
But all the saints aren't raised from the beginning of that time. It's only the sleeping ones that are raised at the beginning of the...
right here.
That thing there.
I think
but there's
right.
still more to come.
I think you're right. And I think the clue there is Revelation 14. Blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth.
Raised first. Yeah.
And that they rest for the works that are in their labors or works followed. It suggests a period of time from this point forward, this condition will continue until the saints are fully complete.
Until the saints are fully completed, then that's when the 1,000 years will take place.
Is this a question or an opinion? I happen to agree with your opinion, so I think that's just fine. But you would opt for this then rather than this.
Yeah.
However, you know that I have not opted for that opinion very long. Most of my life I have opted for this opinion. I have some reasons recently have persuaded me this way. But
have you heard George Kabak's talk about Revelation?
Yeah, when you ask him which way it is, he says both.
Yeah.
Only, not quite. He really says that this takes you to the end of the little season.
Yeah.
There's 1,000 years there and 1,000 years here. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting approach. And
it's in the reprints, you know.
No, it is not.
It isn't?
No, you find it for me. But there is something in the reprints that's very similar.
Yeah.
It's very similar. You'll find it on, I think, reprint page 3450 or 3460. Yeah. I'm not sure. This is really, since we're into that, we'll talk about that just a little bit. This is what you find in the in Brother Russell's writings about 1,000 years. You find on page, is it 39 of volume 2, about the venerable tradition. What is the venerable tradition about the 1,000 years? What is that?
It started in 1874.
Has that been a tradition for hundreds of years that the millennium began in 1874?
I think so, because
was that a tradition before Brother Russell's day?
No.
Nobody could have known that before they knew Christ was
here.
So what is the your answer really is right. It's just not formed right. You really are on the right track. Yes.
Is that papacy's 1,000-year reign?
That's interesting. That's an interesting point. But in volume 2, page 39, he says, the venerable tradition is that it's been venerated for so long that the seventh millennium of man's experience will be the 1,000 years of Christ's reign.
Oh, okay.
Now, when did Brother Russell think the seventh millennium chronologically began?
1872,
but from the fall of man, he said, 1874. So your answer is really right. But just the point of the venerable tradition is that the 1,000 years is the seventh millennium. That's it. Now, why would anybody think otherwise? Or let me ask the question even more pointedly. Why did Brother Russell ever suggest another view than that the 1,000 years began in 1874 and then would end in 2874? Why did he ever suggest a different view? What reason would there be for it?
Keep us on our toes.
I doubt that was his motivation, but it was the way it worked. Well, the obvious reason is because in Revelation 20, verse 4, it says they lived during Christ's 1,000 years, and the church is not yet complete. And you'll find this view very pointedly in a reprint article. See, can I remember the name? I don't know the number. Chai, you probably know it better. Is it 2947 or 2937? It's the reprint article where somebody asked Brother Russell, tell me, you say 6,000 years ended in 1872, the Lord returned in 1874, the saints were raised in 1878, you say Satan won't be bound until 1915. So when's the 1,000 years? Tell me, which way is it? When is it? And his answer is, he never denies that it was started in 1874. He doesn't affirm it there. He never denies it, though. But what his answer is, in three words, I don't know. He says, we may not fully know the answer until the end of the 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. Now, why? Why would he say that there was an ambiguity? If it's 1874 to 2874, I don't find anything ambiguous about that. Why would there be any other opinion on the subject? Because in the very end of the reprint, he says, as regards the reign of the saints, it cannot begin until all the jewels are complete. And he points to Revelation 20, verse 4. That's the text he's talking about. So he had two views. It is correct, I think, to say Brother Russell had two opinions, and he couldn't reconcile them. One said that the 1,000 years would be 1874 to 2874. And the other said that the 1,000 years would be some unknown when the church is complete to 1,000 years later. And that's what he says in that article. Now, you go four years later, you find another article. This is 3460, I think, or 3640. It didn't come with the numbers themselves. And there he says, hey, you know what? There's actually two views that make sense. He says there's two chronological charts. This one shows 2,500 years here and here. This one shows 2,520 years. There's 1,000 years for Adam. There's the 1,000-year kingdom. This shows the 1,000 years starting in 1914. This shows the 1,000 years starting in 1874. And you'll see that article actually has charts. These two, you very rarely see an article with a chart. This one you will. He's got both charts in there. Is this the article somebody was talking about where he has both views? George's view? Is that what you're talking about?
I think it's 34 something.
That's this one. Okay. So he thought that showed that the church would be complete in 1914. That's when the 1,000 years begin. And there's two different views of 1,000 years. Now, did this work?
No.
How do you know?
We're
still here and it's beyond 1940. This didn't work. It just didn't work. So what was his answer after this? He didn't
know.
He still doesn't know. But there's one interesting thing you can trace in Brother Russell's writings about this concern, and that is the Divine Plan of the Ages chart. Do you have one posted anywhere here? I don't see one.
I have a little one.
Do you have a little one?
Verify something.
Yeah, tell me, Tricia. Will you tell? Somebody else tell me. You won't think I'm making this up. What is the kingdom called?
The kingdom. What is it? Small. Okay. What is the kingdom
messianic
called? Messianic age.
Messianic. Mm-hmm. When was it called Messianic age? For the first time on the chart.
Yeah,
you
went through that. Yeah, I know. I had that down.
What was it called originally?
Millennial
age.
Messianic age.
When did it change on the chart?
74,
something like that. Yeah, we found that out.
No. 1914 it changed.
In 1914. No, I haven't independently researched this. And what, say Messianic?
No, it says Millennial.
Millennial. Okay, so that's an old one, and this is a new one. I didn't research this independently, but I understand from Jim Parkinson, who gave me this data, Brother Ned Ranger from the Northwest apparently saw this, that including up to 1914, there were some charts that still called it Millennial. But the later charts in 1914 call it Messianic. So when the church wasn't complete in 1914, I think Brother Russell says, well, you know, I really don't know when the millennium is, and I'm just going to put Messianic and obscure this question. Hmm. Now, I think today we can know. But that's because, you know, I have a different view of chronology now. And I think that tells us we're not yet there. Now, that's a whole other subject, and, you know, I've got more than 2 hours of thoughts on that subject. But I'm going to go back to Revelation here, because this is really the subject for today. But that's why I say that recognizing that there's an overlapping and a harvest does not settle the dispute by itself, not in and of itself. I suppose if you could settle that there was no overlapping, it would settle the problem, but there is an overlapping. So that's a different issue. Okay, now, was there another comment? Okay, so that's the basic concept of Revelation. Now, you can flesh this out a little bit, and I'll just do that real quickly here by saying you have, in this segment, you have the sevens. Well, you have an introduction. That's chapter one. And then you have the sevens. How many sevens are there?
Three.
Three of them. The churches, the seals, and the trumpets. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to sevens. And then you have that woman in chapter 12. Mm-hmm. And then you have, I'm just going to say Babylon, because it's all the false churches, in chapter 13. And that's the end, because chapter 14 going to the harvest. Chapter 14 in the harvest, you have an introduction. That's what chapter 14 is. It's got little fragments about the harvest, but not a lot of detail. What do you have after chapter 14?
15 last plagues.
Sevens again. In this case, only one series. A series of seven plagues. Chapter 17, what do you have?
Judgment.
Judgment of what?
Of the fourth church.
Of, how was she represented?
As a great...
Oh, okay. I don't want even to say it, Harry, but I'm going to put down here the word woman. She's a woman. Only this is the false woman. Are you noticing a parallel here?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what's in the next segment? Chapter 18 and 19. Chapter 18 opens with a pronouncement. Somebody has fallen.
Mm-hmm.
Babylon has fallen. Mm-hmm. So there's Babylon. You see how the Gospel Age section and the Harvest section, writing very awkward here, so it's, I think it's readable. They run in parallel. There's a structure to this book. It's not just random. There's a deliberate structure. This is the way things develop in the Gospel Age. Here's the judgment of them at the end of the age. Very deliberate. Very specific. Now, some of you may have noticed in your study of the symbols of Revelation that the seven plagues here remind you in their symbols very strongly of one of the series of sevens here. Which one is that? Do you recall? Seven trumpets.
Mm-hmm.
The first trumpet was on the earth, the first plague on the earth.
Mm-hmm.
The next one on the sea, the second trumpet on the sea. The next one on the rivers and fountains of water. This one on the rivers and fountains of water. This one on the sun, moon, and star, on the sun, moon, and stars. This one only on the sun, but that's enough to give you the idea. This one there was in the fifth trumpet there was darkness that was caused by these locusts from the pit. Here there was a plague of great darkness. Here there was the Euphrates. Here the Euphrates is dried up.
Mm-hmm.
And here there's a voice from heaven saying, the kingdom of this world is the kingdom of our Lord and his Christ. Here there's a great voice out of heaven saying, it's done. The climax has come. So there's a very strong connection between these. And I think the whole of the Gospel Age and the whole of the harvest are in tandem to each other, showing a deliberate connection. Now you get into the kingdom. I'm going to go down to question number 10, because this brings us right to this issue. Question number 10, I'm going to omit that first part, though. Where is the resurrection spoken about in chapter 20?
You mentioned it earlier.
Chapter
20. In the kingdom.
Yes.
That's verse 4, chapter 20.
There's the resurrection of the saints. Mm-hmm. So we have in chapter 4 verse 20 verse 4 we have the resurrection of the saints. Where is the resurrection of the world referred to?
Verse 12 and 13.
Okay, very good. Now tell me, in the first section of Revelation, this chapter, Where does the 1,000 years end in Revelation 20? I can't say that's wrong, because that is at the end of the 1,000 years. But where does it first end, I should ask? Seven. When the 1,000 years are expired, Satan goes out, and then he deceives the nations, and what happens at the end to the disobedient?
Second death.
There. But you notice that, how does death come to the people in verse 9? It is second death, I agree. How does it come?
Fire came down.
From heaven. How does it happen in verse 14 and 15? Lake of fire from below. You notice that there's two different symbols of the destruction of the ungodly? These are two different, separate, and distinct visions. It's fire in both cases, but it's not the same thing. One, fire comes down like Elijah's day, you know, and consumes them. The other, they're thrown into the fire. Two separate and distinct counts. Now, do you see where Revelation 20, up through verse 10, you have the 1,000 years and its aftermath? Verse 11, you start all over with another vision of the 1,000 years. The great white throne, and then you have the resurrection of the world's dead. Now, in the first vision, you have the resurrection of the saints, but no mention of the resurrection of mankind. Not one mention explicitly about that. In the second vision, this is not about the resurrection of the saints and their rule. This is now about the world of mankind and their experience. And so there you have the resurrection of the world, starting with verse 12, 13, and 14. So you have one vision about the saints, one vision about the world in the resurrection. And then in chapter 21, what is the vision about the kingdom? How is it expressed in symbol in chapter 21?
New Jerusalem coming down from heaven. New Jerusalem.
New Jerusalem. And what does New Jerusalem look like?
We have description in the end.
A long description, but briefly. She looked like
a bride
adorned for her husband. Now, I'm just going to put one word down for that. What word would that be?
Church.
Bride.
That would be good.
Church. No.
But I'm trying to make a connection here.
Woman.
Woman.
Now you see the result of what happened to that virtuous woman.
Yeah.
In chapter 12, she now becomes the virtuous bride. And so I think there's a connection there. And finally, at the very end, chapter 22, verse 5, you have kind of the close of the book. There's the end of the book. I'm just going to put close. There's closing farewells and admonitions and so forth. So you notice that each part of Revelation has four subparts. And those four subparts here in the Gospel and the Harvest are very closely correlated, because the same way things developed here, they are judged in the Harvest. This has to be different because it's a different concept. It's different points. But also four parts. The resurrection, first of the saints, then the world, the glorification of the woman, and then closing the admonitions. And so that's the structure of Revelation. And anything you put into that structure, it will give you a hint how to apply it. If you open it randomly, and it's the sixth chapter, and you're in the fifth seal, okay, well, let's see. Is that the kingdom? Wouldn't work. Is that the harvest? Not yet. That would be the seventh. So you know you've got to be 1, 2, 3, 4. You know you've got to be in here somewhere. And then you can figure out, I know where it is. Now look at the symbols, see what fits. About the time of the Reformation, when the dead saints had been martyred, and they promised white robes. Oh, white robes, oh, that reminds me of, I don't know, like justification. That reminds me of the Middle Ages, you know, the Reformation period. You get an idea where you are if you have a structure to put it into. Tricia?
The ending part, is that in, like, that's not in order, right?
Say again?
It's not in order.
This?
Yeah, as far as...
Yes, it is. In the order of the way it appears.
Glorified until after...
Oh, no, I'm sorry. It's in sequence the way it's related.
Right, but it's not in sequence as into when everything happens.
It kind of is. But remember, this is one view, mm-hmm. and then another of the same thing, and then another of the same thing. So what you've got here in the first part is a vision of the binding of Satan and the replacement of the earthly rulers by the church for 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. Now, the next one, you go back, another vision of the same period of time, but it doesn't start when the first chapter, the first part starts. It starts a little bit later, because now the resurrection of the saint comes first. The resurrection of the word will start a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the same basic period, but it's a little bit later. And so then when you go to this vision is when the church is complete. I guess you could say that's the same time as this, because the saints, you know, actually the world isn't raised until after that happens. So yeah, actually you're right. I think it's true. You're right. This actually starts earlier than that would start. The church is complete before the world comes back. You're right. Very good point. So I guess conceptually you've got to deal with the resurrection. And then you go on to another overall view of the kingdom. Yeah. Yeah, very good point. Now, yeah, I'll just leave it at that. Yeah, very good observation. I never thought that deeply about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Okay, that's any questions about this basic structure? Okay, now there's another way you can break a revelation down, and that takes us to question number two, the basic visions in a book. And this is what I didn't really recognize until some of the brethren in our class in our current study began to piece this together and realize that there are seven basic visions in the book. Now, there's more visions than just seven. I'm talking about seven basic visions, seven different places where John is. Now, where is John when the book of Revelation opens?
Isle of
Patmos. Isle of Patmos. So he's down here on terra firma. He's on the earth. Now, chapters 1, 2, and 3 all happen down here. Chapter 1, he hears a voice behind him. He turns, and he sees Jesus, and he has the vision of the seven churches. After that's complete, we're in chapter 4. What happens in chapter 4? Where does chapter 4 occur? I should ask it that way.
In heaven.
Can you read that first verse for us, would you, Trish?
After this I looked, and behold, a door was opened in heaven, and the first voice which I heard was as it were of a trumpet talking with me, which said, come up hither, and I will show thee things which must be hereafter.
And then he was, what does it say after that?
Verse 2. Immediately I was in the spirit, and behold, a throne was set in heaven, and one sat on the throne.
Okay, and he was, where is it to say he's caught up? Oh, immediately I was in the spirit. Oh, yeah. So John is really caught up through that door, and now he's no longer down here. He's now up there. And then he sees the throne of God. Well, what would you expect God to be? In heaven. So he's up in heaven now looking at the whole thing. Now, it was Isaac Newton that wrote a small book on the prophecies of Daniel and the Apocalypse, which I just got a couple of years ago. And Isaac Newton says that when you go to this throne scene in chapter 4, in the throne of God, imagine you're at Jerusalem. And that John is outside the wall on the east side of Jerusalem. Now, if you've never been there, maybe you've seen a picture. Some of you have been there. You look from the east, looking westward to Jerusalem, and you see a large wall. And then on top of the wall, you see that Temple Mount, and that's where the Mosque of Omar is, the Dome of the Rock. And if John was down at the bottom, it would be an awful long wall. That's what he says is going on here. John's picked up in vision through that door in heaven, and now he's up at the Temple Mount in the temple area. And what would you see in the temple? You open the temple, you see inside the Ark of the Covenant, and that's where God sits upon his throne. And you go piece by piece through this, and Isaac Newton suggests this is a picture of the temple in Jerusalem. Of course, it's a picture of God's throne and the glory all around God's throne. And I think if you think of that scene, and you compare these things, you'll find some reason for the various symbols that are involved here. But anyway, the point is you're up there, not down here. So I'm going to say that's vision number two, basic venue number two, up there instead of down here. That lasts for all of the seals, and the seals, that blends right into the trumpets, and that takes you through chapter 11. Now chapter 12. There appeared a great wonder in heaven, and he's still in heaven, but he's seeing an altogether fresh, new vision. This is a wonder in heaven that's totally different than anything he's seen before. And so I think chapter 12 begins another set of prophecies. Now chapter 12 and chapter 13 blend in together in a way that I never saw until my brother Robin brought to my attention in our study in Revelation. Look at Revelation 12, verse 12. Now you know the story of Revelation 12. A lot of stuff we're skipping here, just depending on the story is, in Revelation 12, I saw a woman who was ready to give birth, and the dragon was ready to devour that man-child as soon as it was born. Who was that dragon?
Civil power.
Pagan Rome. Pagan Roman Empire at the opening of the Gospel Age, ready to devour incipient Christianity as soon as it got strength, as it were. And then it says that ultimately there was a war in heaven. Who lost the war?
Dragon.
The dragon. He was cast out of heaven. Where is he if he's not in heaven?
On earth.
But now let's see what it says in verse 12. Verse 12. Ella, would you read that?
Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury because he knows that his time is short.
Okay, so the devil's down at the earth, and who else is in peril?
You. Mm-hmm.
All of us are, yeah. Mm-hmm. But other than the earth, what other segment of this planet is in peril?
The sea.
Mm-hmm. So may I suggest that he's planted up life on the seashore? That's where he comes out of heaven, and I think he goes down to the seashore. Now, where is John? And the whole vision of Revelation?
He's on an island.
On an island. So it makes sense there would be a seashore there. Now, there's a big wilderness here, too, so I don't know if it's really the whole vision is about Patmos, but the concept that there's on a seashore here makes sense. The devil is cast out on the seashore. Now, in chapter 13, verse 1. Ella, you have New American Standard?
No, NIV.
NIV, read that. That would give us the right thought.
Verse 13, what did you say?
13, verse 1.
Okay. It's continuing. Those who obey God's commandments and hold to the testimony of Jesus. Okay, that's it. Okay, and the dragon stood on the shore of the sea.
Okay. Does anybody else say the same thing in their version?
No.
No? What does yours say?
And I saw a beast rising out of the sea.
Who is standing on the seashore?
I.
Who is I?
John.
That's a big difference. Was John standing on the seashore, or was the dragon standing on the seashore? And apparently the better manuscripts say it's the dragon, not John. Now, this is a little bit disturbing to me because I don't know how to get the flow. But the point is that chapter 12 flows right into chapter 13. Chapter 12, you saw the dragon on the seashore. The earth and the sea was in peril because he's right on the junction between the two. Chapter 13, there he is, still there. Now, does the dragon appear elsewhere in chapter 13?
Yeah.
Verse 4, the dragon's still active in this vision. And what is he doing in verse 4?
His power to beast.
Who's the beast?
The papacy.
Papacy. So the dragon yields its authority. Pagan Rome yields its authority to Catholic Rome, Papal Rome. Now, you see, if this blends right into chapter 12, it's really all one continuing narrative. You think about the early church history, what happened? The church began to develop. He replaced it. And the woman, where did she, what happened to her? She had to flee into the wilderness for...
1260.
That's it. You got that in rote memory, right? Yeah. So that's the 1260 years. But you see that this 1260 years was also the time when papacy developed and persecuted the saints. And chapter 13 is telling you that at the beginning of that 1260, papacy got power, and it's blending right in. Chapter 12 and 13 blend in as one vision. Now, that may lead to some questions in the interpretation. It did to me. But there's good answers for it. But 12 and 13 is all one view. Now, what happens at the end of chapter 13? Who else comes along other than the papacy? Chai, you already answered.
Two horned beasts.
Church of England. Mm-hmm. Church of England is like an imitation of papacy. Mm-hmm. Papacy was that church that had an empire from Rome and was everywhere. But when the British Empire went everywhere, the Church of England went everywhere just like Rome did. It's like a copycat of the Church of Rome, and that's why it's, I think, in the prophecy here. Now, you know, we could spend a lot of time thinking about why it should be the Church of England. We're skipping a lot of that. We're assuming a lot here that needs to be backfilled. But just trying to give you the overview, here's the Church of England that rises up kind of compatible with the Church of Rome. And now, what comes after that? And we're going to break soon, but I'm going to just finish this thought.
Yes, the image of the beast.
Image of the beast. And then in chapter 14... I look. Chapter 13. What happens to the true saints?
They are persecuted unless they worship the beast.
And what's the evidence of that? The evidence of the worshiping of the beast.
The mark.
The mark of the beast. And where is the mark?
In the forehead.
In the forehead. Or the hand. Or the hand. Get that in just a minute. Now, chapter 14. What do you see? Verse 1.
The 144,000 in the Mount Zion.
And what do they got?
Names written on the forehead.
That's it. There's the contrast between 13. There's the nominal in 13. There's the true in 14. But you see how it's blending right together? It's one narrative. There's not a break. I looked and I saw something new. But it's not a separate venue. It's a continuing narrative. 12, 13, and 14. It's giving you, rolls right into the harvest. And now the church is complete. And then you get on in chapter 14. You don't get another main vision until you get to chapter 15. I saw another sign in heaven. Where's the last sign we saw?
Chapter 12.
Chapter 12. I saw a great wonder or sign in heaven, the woman. You don't get to another one until you get to chapter 15. I saw another one. And that's 15 is the beginning of the next vision. And I think because of time, we better take that first dimension. So.
Okay, friends, we'll...
Okay, we were outlining the seven visions. Now, in chapter 15, that's when he sees another sign in heaven. And that's chapter 15 and chapter 16. And then in chapter 17, there came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials and said, now I'll show you something else. I think it's an entirely different scene. He's taken out into the wilderness here, and there's an altogether another vision. 17 begins a new episode altogether. Now, one thing I didn't realize before is that 17 and 18 blend together. Now, I want to get back to this. There's so many things I'd get back to. Time won't really permit all of this. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Let me just say that 17 and 18 do blend together. I'll get back to that in a while. 18 and 19 are part of one story. 19 and 20 blend together. And we talk about this in the intermission. 19, you have the beast, and then the false prophet are destroyed. Chapter 20, the dragon is destroyed. It blends right together. You don't get another vision, really, main vision, until chapter 21, verse 2. I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down. Verse 10, he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain. He's in a new venue now, altogether. So I'm going to say 21:2 starts a new vision of New Jerusalem. And that doesn't end until chapter 22, verse 5, to the closing section of the book. Now, how many visions there overall in Revelation do we have?
Seven.
I find that very intriguing. And I never saw this until we studied these in our class. And there's seven different basic venues, basic visions in Revelation. And within each one of these segments, the vision actually connects chapter after chapter after chapter. It's a sequence. And then you have a break altogether. So that's an altogether different way of outlining the book. But I find these, especially since it hits seven, I find, well, that strikes it as potentially meaningful. Now, I could take this a step deeper and look at the meaning of each of these seven and suggest that there's something in each of these seven meanings that correlate with the seven stages of the church. But that would be another hour, and I'm not going to go there. But I think there's a meaning to it. There's a meaning to this structure as well as a meaning to this structure. Time-wise and vision-wise, Revelation can be split up different ways. It's a very cleverly crafted book, as you would expect from the divine mind. Mm-hmm. But now, I'll just leave that as a seed thought. You can develop that later. Let's go back to question number 2. Seven main parts to the book. Can you decipher where each begins and ends? Now, we just answered that. We went through all of that here. Those are the seven main visions. Okay, let's get back to some of the simple stuff that we should have started with, and it's question number 3. The basic time for this whole book, where does the book come from? And does this have any meaning? What's the basic time frame of this book? Does anybody have any general comments on any of this in question number 3? Where does the book come from? Okay, that's interesting, because the only place where there's, the first place there's a reference to a book per se, mm-hmm. is that scroll in the right hand of God. Okay, but that's not where the book of Revelation itself comes from. John, you answered the question right.
If you say what you see, what it will be, you write it.
That's right. Now, where does what he sees and hears come from?
Jesus.
Mm-hmm. So Jesus just dreamt all this up himself and gave it to John. Is that right? So Jesus thought it up and gave it to John. Mm-hmm. That's what we got.
Well, he got it from the Almighty.
That's the point.
Right.
Chapter 1. The answers are all right. I'm just looking to the next step of the answer. That's right. Chapter 1. Yes.
In my introduction, my Bible, it says that the letter was written due to persecution begun by the emperor against Christians. So...
May I suggest that it probably was written because John got it and was told to write it. but I understand what they're saying. That's maybe the right time frame.
The point they're making, or the point that I would make with reading that, is the fact that the book was written with a specific purpose, with one of many specific purposes. But one of the specific purposes was to encourage the saints, and the fact that we're living in a world that is governed by Satan. There's bound to be persecution, and therefore this is meant to be a real source of encouragement to the brethren.
Exactly. Very good point. By the way, I'm going to erase this now. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Anybody that wants just got it. And let's see just where. Now, Rick, I think, is told us that originally this book came from God. These visions came from God originally. I'll leave that part till I have to erase it in a few minutes. How do we know that? Other than that, that makes sense. Rick, specifically, how do you know that it came from God?
Well, 1:1 says, which God gave unto him.
Okay. That's pretty clear.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah,
okay. So it comes from God, and then it goes to Jesus. Jesus got it from God. Mm-hmm. And so then Jesus gave it to John. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what the first verse says?
Yeah.
His angel to his servant John.
His angel to his servant John. So Jesus went from Jesus mm-hmm. to the angel. And then it went to John. Am I reading that right?
Yeah.
I think so. I think it's telling us four parties to this thing. John received it through an angel. The angel was sent by Jesus. Jesus got it from God.
Could you explain, signified it, what that means here?
Yeah, I remember Brother Earl Fowler, who was the West Coast Revelation brother, you know, many years ago. He's long since gone. He always would start his talks with this. Mm-hmm. He said signifying means he put it into signs and symbols. Mm-hmm. He signified it by putting it into signs for us. And I'd never really looked at the point of the word in the Greek, but I'm assuming that that's mm-hmm. the concept.
And who would be the angel then here?
Very good question.
Who does the sign, mm-hmm. signifying it?
Okay. Who is the angel? Who does John represent? Who is the angel? Any comments on that? Let me ask you this. Where was John when he got the vision?
Patmos.
Out of Patmos. When did he get the vision? What day was it?
Lord's Day.
What day is that?
First day of Lord's Day.
First day of the week.
First day.
The Lord's Day. I think that time has a meaning. You find anywhere else in Scripture the expression, the day of the Lord, in the New Testament? Where do you find it, Trish?
No,
that's that's all right. Yeah. It's 2 Peter.
The
day of the Lord, as a thief in the night. Is it possible there's a connection between this Lord's day and the day of the Lord antitypically? Is it possible that if he told us the day of the week that the vision was given on, that day of the week has some meaning to us? I think it might, if it's meaningful, maybe it tells us that this is the concept of revelation is a concept of a message of truth that comes on the day of the harvest to the last stage of the church. Now let's just test this and see if this makes sense. Or is it just way out of line, too incredible? Mm-hmm. Now John was there and he heard a voice. Where was the voice?
Behind him.
Behind him. Now I think those little details make some sense, make some difference. So if it's the church in the flesh during the harvest and we want to see the history of the gospel age in the seven churches, what do we have to do?
Looking back.
Turn and look beyond us to see the history of the gospel age. Mm-hmm. I think John represents the church at the end of the age who has the vision of the truth revealed and the prophecies of the Lord's word revealed. Now, literally, of course, it happened way 2,000 years ago. But John is a picture of somebody. Mm-hmm. Now, have you ever heard the concept that John pictures the feet members of the body of Christ?
Mm-hmm.
Why would there be any support for that view other than here in Revelation? Any other scripture that might give some support for that concept?
What about when Jesus is talking about when John would die? He said, if I said that he would tarry till I come, what is it to thee?
There you go. Very odd saying.
Yeah.
John 22. You know, he turns to Peter, and he tells Peter something. And, you know, I think Peter understood. Maybe not immediately, but certainly thereafter. He knew what it meant. He says, when you were young, you went wherever you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
When you're old, they're going to take you where you don't want to go. And he knew that, and then it said, this he said, speaking of the way that he would die.
Right.
And he died by crucifixion, led by somebody he didn't prefer, perhaps. And so Peter, you know, the impetuous one, he said, what do you say in this situation?
Yeah.
What about him? So he turns to John, what about him?
Yeah.
And Jesus said, what if I would that he would remain until I come again?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is that to you? Your burden is enough for you.
Mm-hmm.
So this saying went around to all the brethren, John would not die until the Lord would come again. And was there anything that gave some impetus to this as the years passed by?
John lived
He outlived all the others. All the others had died, John kept living. You can see how this would fan the flames. Yeah, he was in his 90s now. He's not going to die. But then John explains, but he didn't say that. He just said, if I will, then what is that to thee? But maybe it makes a symbol of John, of those in the church that would live until the return of Christ. Maybe then that combines with John being in the Isle of Patmos on the day of the Lord, the day of the Lord's return, when the church collectively looks behind them to see history of the gospel age. I think that that's the right concept. If that's true, you notice that John gets the revelation from who?
From an angel.
From an angel, and the angel gets it from?
Jesus.
Does that perhaps synchronize, at least, with the time of our Lord's return, when he gives us meat in due season, gives us the vision of truth, the understanding of where we are, where we've been through, and so forth? But if that's true, how do we get the vision of present truth? Does Jesus come down and give it to us personally? Who's that angel? Could be the Holy Spirit, or could be the seventh messenger, the messenger to that church. I think that's Brother Russell. I think that that's the point. I think Brother Russell is this angel, personally. Now, if that's true, then we have a time frame. We have a time frame for this whole book, that the whole thing has its present location as of the Lord's return. Backward is earlier in the Gospel age, forward is ahead of us. Now, let's see how that has some impact on the visions when you get into chapter 17. Chapter 17, verse 10, tells us a time point in the narrative. Brother Richard, could you read verse 10 for us?
Verse 10?
Yes.
and there are seven kings. Let's see, I'll put my glasses on. Five are falling, and one is, and the other is not yet come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space.
Now, what those seven heads are has been a discussion for a long time. And I understand that Brother Russell even said, you know, I can't write Revelation about until I understand the 17th chapter. And he didn't understand it by his own admission. Even on his deathbed, when somebody said, well, what about volume 7? Somebody else had to write that. He just didn't have the clue. Didn't have the key, rather. The key, I think, was here. I think there's a reason he couldn't see it. Chapter 17, if we follow this concept of time, that means as of our Lord's return, five heads had already come and gone upon this this Roman people, this institution that was written over by papacy. One existed at our Lord's return, and one more was yet to come future. Now, if this is on the right track, then we can go back historically and see what were the main Christian body of leadership that came through the gospel age that papacy had some connection or power with. Well, I would say the first one, and this is going to be very interpretive and it's going to be very quick. I understand that. But I think that first one is Justinian. And I have to read my notes to see who I think the second one is. I can't remember. Oh, yeah. Charlemagne. And then, do you know where the Holy Roman Empire really began? I would have said Charlemagne, but I would be technically wrong. I didn't know this until just a few months ago. Technically, the Holy Roman Empire began with Otto the Great. And after that, you had Charles V. That was about the time of the Reformation. Then you had Napoleon. We think of Napoleon as somebody who conquered papacy, and he did. He was very rough to them, but he also made a concordat with them when he realized it was expedient to have their political authority, their religious authority on his side. And so I think Napoleon was the fifth one. That would mean the sixth one at the time of the Second Advent. And this one is identified in the reprints. Remember who it might have been? The one at the time of the Lord's return that governed Rome was Victor Emmanuel. He's not identified in the reprints, though, as number six. He's identified in the reprints as number seven. Why would that be? Because Brother Russell thought this would be the last form, expecting the church complete in 1914. The church wasn't complete in 1914. Who took over from Victor Emmanuel and his dynasty? Well, his son did, but finally they abdicated in favor of another person, somebody who had a lot of popular support and became a dictator in Italy.
Mussolini.
He abdicated in favor of Mussolini. Who did Mussolini make a compact with?
Hitler.
They controlled Europe briefly. It wasn't a long time like these others, just very briefly. Now let's see if this makes sense. Five heads are fallen, one exists, and one is yet to come, and he will endure for a very short space. It was a short period that they had their rule over Europe. Now let's see what happens after that. Verse 11. the beast, which verse 15 says are the peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues that the whore wrote over. Verse 15 says that. Verse 11, the beast that was and is not, he is the eighth. Now, how many heads were there on this beast?
Seven.
Well, how can the beast be the eighth? Well, he's not an eighth head, but he's the eighth expression of power of this beast.
Of the one of the seven.
Say again?
He's the one of the seven.
Oh, and it says it's like one of the seven. It's of the seven.
Belongs to the seven.
Okay, belongs to the seven. So suddenly the number eight is the beast itself. I think that would be the peoples themselves that are going to rise up and overthrow the person on top of them. Now, did anything like that happen ever before where the people rose up and threw over papacy briefly?
The French Revolution.
Who was the head at that time?
Louis XVI.
You're right. But who was the head on this list that would be in that
Napoleon.
Period of history? Napoleon. Your answer was perfect. It was exactly right. But I this is what I meant, one of the five. So this one, when that happens, that will be something like what happened under Napoleon. So that's why it's of the seven. It's like that one. And then finally, the next phase, well, there is no more phase. That's when the whole thing falls apart and there is no more. You know, Christ takes over from there. So if the concept that we eased into this through Brother Rick's answers was that John represents the church class in the flesh at the end of the age, then this time point does make sense. And it also makes sense why Brother Russell could never see the fulfillment of chapter 17. He couldn't possibly. He didn't live to see Hitler Mussolini. It would be, who would have guessed, you know, at that time? Who would have guessed? But now we have lived long enough, we see that. Do you expect another dictator to arise in Europe? I don't think so. I think that war phase is over. That's over. This is the next thing, as far as their experience. So the time frame does make sense out of chapter 17. There's a lot of details in chapter 17 we didn't go into. The time frame does help to explain it. But now, notice this subtle point that I never did until somebody brought it up in our study and forced me to see it. Chapter 17 ends by saying, the beast, verse 16, the ten horns which thou sawest upon and the beast is the way it should be in better translation. These shall hate the whore and make her desolate and naked and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. You notice it's put in the future tense? You notice it shall happen. Shall happen. Where are we in John's day? We're still right here at the Lord's return. All of that, the coming of this head, the coming of this head, the coming of this beast, and what happens to the papacy at this time, all that is future. And so it shall. Where are we in chapter 17? We're still at the beginning of the harvest. That's why it shall happen, but he didn't see it happen. He just said it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Now we blend right into the next verse. After these things, I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great power, and he cried mightily. And what's the message of this angel? Has, is, or will be?
Yes.
Is, present tense. Where are we? We're at the beginning of the harvest. Where did that message come out? At the beginning of the harvest. See how chapter 17 and 18 blend right together. They're all part of one sequence. Chapter 18 is the judgment of great Christendom and actually shows you when it finally ends. Verse 20. Rejoice over her, thou heaven and ye holy apostles. And verse 21. A mighty angel took up a millstone with violence, so that city Babylon be thrown down and found no more. Verse 24. In her was found the blood of prophets. Chapter 19. A great praise of thanksgiving. Hallelujah. This whole thing is finally complete, finished, done. Now the bride is ready to be married. You see, we're right in chapter 17, 18, 19, all continuous in sequence. They're all one vision. Now let's see how chapter 19 ends. Chapter 19 ends with another vision of Armageddon. It goes back in time a little bit to pick up the same thread of thought. Verse 19. Rebecca, would you read that for us? 19 and 20.
And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat upon the horse and against his army. And the beast was seized, and with him the false prophet, who performed the signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image.
Okay, now, you remember back in Revelation 16, just before Armageddon, we've got three entities that come together for their last stand before Armageddon. What are those three entities? Jonathan?
Dragon.
And?
Beast.
False prophet.
False prophet,
exactly. And in that sequence, by the way, now I almost always say the beast, the dragon, and the false prophet. My brother Robin has been correcting me on that for about 2 years now. Maybe someday I'll get it into my brain. It is the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. And this is the way it was introduced to us in Revelation 12. The dragon in chapter 12, then the beast in chapter 13, and then the false prophet. And that's the way it always appears when the three of them, you know, when that group of names appears, always the dragon, the beast, the false prophet. So Jonathan started this off correctly, dragon. Now, in chapter 19, what has been destroyed in chapter 19?
The nations.
Okay, that's true, because early in chapter 19, he's smiting the nations. But in the verses we just read by Rebecca, what entities have been destroyed in those verses?
Beast and the false prophet.
That's it. So, okay, we got that taken care of. We got that taken care of. What is missing?
The dragon.
What do we have in chapter 20?
The dragon.
Mm-hmm. You see now why, say, Revelation 19 and 20 flows right together. There's the beast. There's the false prophet. Now, finally, we got the dragon checked off the list. Those are the three parties that come together in Armageddon. Those are the three parties that are destroyed in Armageddon. Beast, dragon, false prophet, and then you pick up the dragon. And why does he delay the dragon until chapter 20? My opinion is because the dragon represents what?
Civil
power. And now in chapter 20, he's ready to talk about the saints that are going to take the authority from civil power and rule instead of the governments of this earth. Now, with that thought in mind, let's go to verse 4 of chapter 20. And this may throw you for a loop, but actually, it goes back to an early reprint article where Brother Russell, I think, saw something here that is not customarily picked up. Chapter 20, verse 4. Judith, could you read that for us, the first part of verse 4?
Excuse me. I was trying to find my place.
Oh, yeah, we're in chapter 20 here.
Okay, 20, verse 4?
Yes, please.
And I saw the throne, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given to them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of the testimony of Jesus and because of the word of God, those who had not worshiped the beast or his image and had not received the mark upon their forehead and upon their head. Their hand, and they came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years.
Okay. Now, he opens this verse by saying, I saw thrones, and they sat on them. What thrones and who's sitting on them?
Over the government.
Chai, you have a head start on this. Chai and I have been emailing back and forth on this for some time now. But I think that's right. The normal answer I would have given some years ago is that these are the thrones of the saints.
Yeah.
I think that's a very popular thought. I've given a whole talk on this subject, you know, combining this, proving it from Daniel. I don't think I'm right. I think this is the throne of earthly rulers. And I go back to an early reprint article where Brother Russell did identify it this way. But here's the reason. How are the saints pictured in verse 4?
Beheaded.
And I saw the souls of them. They're dead. When are they resurrected in verse 4? Within verse 4, where?
The very end.
The very end, they came to life. So what do you got, dead saints sitting on thrones?
No.
It just doesn't, when you realize that's the dead saints, it doesn't quite add up. But here's number 2, item number 2. Judgment was given unto them. That word judgment, it's the word krima. Now, do you remember enough of what this, we talk about crisis and krima sometimes?
Yeah.
Crisis is like the judgment. In Matthew, where, John the 5th chapter, all that are in their grave shall come forward, those that are doing good to life, those that are doing evil to a resurrection of crisis, process of judgment, investigation, proof. But this says krima. Krima is condemnation, verdict, sentence. So these ones on the thrones are given a krima. They're not given a crisis. They're given a, well, I guess it is a crisis for them, in English. But they're given a condemnation. And this is what Brother Russell points out in that earlier article. I'm sorry I don't have the citation directly. You'll find it easily in the comments, though. That the word krima means judgment, and it's the condemnation that they have received. Now, there's a scripture in the Old Testament that says, I will shake the kingdoms, and I will shake the throne of kingdoms. I think that's in Haggai. The throne of kingdoms is the Old Testament reference to earthly rulers. That's why here you see thrones. Now, in Revelation, do you ever see multiple thrones of the saints anywhere in Revelation, if other than here? No, you don't. Never do you see any reference in Revelation to multiple thrones of the saints. Revelation 3:21 or 22, whatever it is, he that overcometh, I will give to sit with me in my throne, as I am sit down with my Father in his throne. Revelation 22, I saw the throne of God and of the Lamb. But you don't see 144,000 thrones. They're set down collectively in one throne. Now, you can get it from Matthew. You have followed me in the regeneration. You shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes. But, you know, when you think about it, maybe that's the 12 disciples that are going to judge, you know, the 12. I'm not sure. But nowhere does thrones, plural, refer to the thrones of the saints in Revelation. That helps me, again, to see these thrones, plural, are probably the civil rulers. And what's happening, the reason that I'm saying that the dragon was delayed was because it's delayed until you see the time when the saints are going to replace them as the new rulers of earth and replace the old civil authorities. And therefore, the beast is taken with him, the false prophet, and the dragon is replaced by the resurrected saints that come back to life. I think that's the point. So chapter 19 and 20 blend together. Well, our time is going, and is that clock we're going by, right? I like that clock better than mine. So, okay. So let's go back to, this is question number three, basic time. I think if you use this time frame, you'll find out that Revelation does make sense with this time frame of the harvest church, the end of the age. This is when Jesus gives us the vision of present truth, and it's when, to the John class, he opens up the history even of the gospel age and its symbols. The angel, I think probably the seventh angel, the seventh messenger. I think that's probably Charles Russell. Now let's go to with that thought in mind, let me go forward a little bit into chapter 19, verse 10. And let's see what John does to this angel. Let's see what we should or shouldn't do about this. Helen, could you read that for us? Revelation 19, verse 10.
And I fell at his feet to worship him. And he said unto me, see that thou do it not. I am thy fellow servant and of thy brethren that have the testimony of Jesus, worship God. For the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy.
Would that fit if this was the seventh messenger?
Mm-hmm.
It would. Sure. We're not supposed to fall down and worship him for the things he says. We're supposed to worship God. He's merely a vehicle. Was he a perfect vehicle?
No.
No, of course. He was an imperfect vehicle, like we all are. Mm-hmm. And as he himself said, inspiration ended with the apostles, and the seven messengers didn't have the same level of, that kind of direction. Do you know of anybody that has a little icon of Brother Russell in their house that they worship? I hope not. I don't think. Rick says no. I don't know of anybody. Is this just a hollow point then? Don't worship me. What does that mean? Does that have any meaning, or is that just a hollow, threat against something that nobody would ever think to do? What does it mean to worship him?
In the mind.
Sister?
I think it's to put him on a pedestal.
Yes. And how do we do that? We appreciate him, respect him. I think the way we do that is by saying, volume 4, page 29, paragraph 3 says, and therefore, that's not the way you use the writings of the seventh messenger. Mm-hmm. You test them by, what is it, the spirit of prophecy, which is the testimony of Jesus. Mm-hmm. You test it by the word that's written for us. And therefore, I think that this is a legitimate test on the church. It really is a problem. It's a problem whenever we say, I believe this because it's on page, paragraph, and number. Then we are no longer putting it on the scriptures. And if there's a clarification to be made, we have no access to that. That's why we shouldn't do this. It is a problem. Now, one more, Helen.
Well, I think that in the very first volume, mm-hmm. Brother Russell speaks, and he writes, and he says, that don't take my word for it. Take the scriptures and then prove it, mm-hmm. and then make it your own. He does not say to make my word your own.
In fact, he even cites the problem that's prevalent in his day, mm-hmm. to find good people of the past who've taught and spoke very eloquently and not see beyond what they have seen. Now, if we take that position, we would never see the application, for instance, of Revelation 17, because he couldn't see it. And some things that he may have said that were not quite, in harmony with what seems we can retrospectively see, that would be close to us. So I think that this verse is telling us something very directly to the Harvest Church. Now, there's a whole segment of the Harvest Brethren that have, I think, not done this properly and have closed the door to the high calling ever since way back. But because they said, look, Brother Russell said, and that's really where the door to the high calling closed. closed in 1918 because of a reprint article, 5950. You can see, I didn't know this until Jim Watkins brought it to my attention when he was visiting our home recently. But he says, you know, there's a reprint article not published in the reprints we have because it was written under Judge Rutherford. But it gives his reason for closing the door in 1918. He referred to the harvest not yet ended, showing the date 1918. He picked that date out of the reprints, he closed the door on that date, and that's the end of that. This text really has a lot of meaning, because you can't just do that. You've got to go by the spirit of truth, the spirit of prophecy. So I think it's a very legitimate warning to the Harvest Church directly. Now, going back the book, question number four, I think we have time for. The book opens with greetings from three entities. Who are they?
The book
from
God, from the Spirit,
the Spirits,
and Jesus.
And Jesus, that's mm-hmm. it. That's the way the book opens. Now, I think it's very nice to have greetings from God. That's priority, that's number one. It comes from God, so that makes sense. That's John, Revelation 1, verse 4. Mm-hmm. Sister Carolyn, could you read that for us?
John, to the seven churches which are in Asia, grace be unto you, and peace from him which is, and which was, and which is to come.
There's God. There's Jehovah, and he's identified this way in chapter 4 on his throne. Go ahead.
And from the seven spirits which are before his throne.
Now, what do you actually see in chapter 4 that are before his throne? Do you see seven spirit beings?
Verse 5.
What do you see there, Chai?
And out of the throne proceeded lightning and thundering and voices, and there were seven lamps of fire burning before the throne, which are the seven spirits of God.
So these lamps are symbolic of the seven spirits. What is a spirit?
An attitude or a
it could be
thing
an attitude.
You carry out.
Could be an attitude or a thing you carry out. Could be. Have you ever heard a greeting from an attitude? I heard greetings with an attitude.
Yeah.
I never heard a greeting from an attitude.
No, but it's even deeper than that. It's
it like might be deeper than. Yeah.
An attitude to me means like, you know, the real thing that you are about, what you represent totally. It's your character more so. Everything stems from the depth of your character, which is indeed what you are.
Yeah.
So it's coming from the totality of what you are.
Okay.
Like spirit.
Now, I think I heard some questions about what scripture was that. So she was.
I'm confused.
Okay.
Chai read a different one than
4:5.
Then Carolyn, yeah. Chai was reading chapter 4, verse 5. There, because in chapter 1 that Carolyn read, verse 4, it says, the seven spirits which are before his throne.
Mm-hmm.
So Chai went to chapter 4 where his throne is and said the seven lamps there are the seven spirits. Mm-hmm. The lamp obviously is a symbol.
And
what is it?
There is another reference for the seven spirits in chapter 5, verse 6. And
five,
I beheld,
six?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And I beheld those in the midst of the throne and out of the four beasts.
Go ahead.
Out of the four beasts and in the midst of the elders stood a lamb as it had been slain, having. Having are the seven spirits of God.
Which are the
sent forth from the earth.
Okay.
Sent forth into the earth.
So we got seven lamps, now we got seven horns on the lamb. All both represent the seven spirits of God.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Another one in 3:1.
Okay.
Revelation 3:1. And to the angel of the church in Sardis write, the words of him who has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars.
Okay. Seven mm-hmm. spirits and the seven stars. Now let's go over to chapter 8
mm-hmm.
and notice what it says in verse 2. This is where observing a very small word might make a difference. Let's see. Brother Joe, would you read that for us?
8:2,
yes.
And I saw the seven angels which stood before God, and to them were given seven trumpets.
You notice the little word I want to focus on is the word the. I saw the seven angels. Have we seen those seven angels before? The seven angels which stood before God.
Seven spirits.
I think that's what it is. I think that's the point. I think the seven spirits mean seven spirit beings, which are angels, and which are the seven angels that blow these trumpets. I think that's the point. Now, I'm not positive on that, but that's something else that came from a Revelation study recently. My brother Robin introduced me to that, too. I think he's right. He made the point that it's these seven angels, implying you have seen them before. And
the seven angels that stand before God would be the seven spirits. Now, earlier, somebody just read, just before this, chapter 5, where it says, quote, chapter 3, was it?
No, 4.
Well, I think it was chapter 3. Verse 1, yeah. These things saith he that hath the seven spirits and the seven stars. Mm-hmm. Now, the seven spirits and seven stars seem to be distinct, but I think they're only distinct in the symbology. I think the seven spirits are the seven spirit beings before the throne, as it were, and the seven stars are showing their representation as light bearers. Mm-hmm. But I think anatypically they're the same group. They're the same people. And therefore, the seven angels standing before God that blow these trumpets are probably those seven spirits that stood before his throne. Like I said, I'm not positive. If you have some reflections on this one way or the other, you know, as you think it over, well, share them with me. But I think that's the point. I think these seven spirits are the seven angels going later.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting point, because the word spirit means an influence. And so you have the seven influencers of God. And it actually fits. I never thought of it, but it fits actually pretty well.
Yeah. That's, when I deliberated on it, I kind of thought he might be right. Richard, did you have a comment? Okay. So, if that's true, later in Revelation, these seven... Oh, well, let's take the next step further. Chapter 15, when the plagues come, you remember we said that there was a big connection between the trumpets and the plagues? Mm-hmm. The trumpets are blown by the seven spirits, mm-hmm. seven angels, stand before God. Now, the plagues are poured also by, it says in verse 1, chapter 15, 1, another sign in heaven, seven angels having the seven last plagues, seven angels. These seven spirit beings, as it were, these seven spirits, are pouring those out as well. And then it says in chapter 17, verse 1, one of the seven angels which had the seven vials said, now I'll show you something more. I'll show you the bad woman and her judgment. Get to chapter 21, and one of the seven angels said, now I'll show you something more. I'll show you the good woman and her judgment. And you've got the angel. Now, one of those seven angels shows the John class these things. Which one of those seven spirits do you think this was?
Seventh.
I think the seventh one, the seventh messenger. I think that's the one opening the book, the angel from which this comes from Jesus to John. I think that's the seventh messenger. Yes, Trish?
Okay, in chapter 1, it says, point 1, verse 20, the mystery of the seven stars, which you saw in my right hand, and the seven golden candlesticks, and the seven stars are the angels of the seven churches.
Yes.
Now there's another seven...
Seven stars. I think what we've got is two different symbols here for the same class. We've got the seven stars are shown as luminous light bearers to the church. The seven angels with trumpets are shown as the judgment givers to the nominal systems. Those are trumpet blast messages. These are the enlightenment to the church. So to the seven stages of the church, you have the seven stars. To the nominal Christendom, you got the seven blares of trumpets. I think they're the same class. I think it's just different symbology used.
Okay, then is that the same as the angels in 4-5?
4-5?
You said that the ones in 4-5 were spirit beings around the throne.
Which are the seven spirits of God, yes. I still think it's the same.
So they're not the same as the seven angels to the church and different from the seven spirits?
I don't think so.
No.
I think they're the same.
So they're not spirit beings then?
Well, what is an angel? Normally.
Spirit being.
I think in the symbol, there's seven spirits, seven spirit beings that stand before God. But it really, in fact, those seven spirit beings represent the messengers to the church who are quite fleshly.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, I admit that while it all seems vaguely to come together, there are some imprecisions, there's some questions I still have. But that's why I say chew on that a little bit, and, you know, we'll see what you think about it and give me some feedback. But it does make a certain consistent sense to me. With all of this. Because after all, you've got to get from that angel in chapter 1, if that's the same angel that John bowed down to in chapter 19 and chapter 21, and that angel clearly is one of the seven angels which poured out the plagues, you start making connections. I think they're all the seven angels, seven spirits are the same. Anyway, I'll drop that at this point. There's some imprecision there. Only got a couple of minutes left here. I think we've covered some of the other issues. We don't have time to get into the plagues. This is too much. So, I'll just say, what else do you have to say or ask? Yes, Tricia.
I have two questions, but I don't know if I'm answering. The first one would be, now, the message of Revelation is to
the true church and the false church.
I think so.
Why isn't Israel mentioned at all?
Because Israel is not really part of the issue for the gospel age, except in one sense. And that is that they were judged very strongly during the first age of the church. And that, I do think you find in the first trumpet. First trumpet blew, and there was an earthquake, and there was hail and fire thrown down to the earth, and all the green grass was burnt up, and a third of the trees. I think that's the judgment in Judaism in 70 AD. That's where you find it. But for the rest of the gospel age, you don't have anything with respect to Israel. Oh, I see your question is still legitimate, though, because we do have the whole kingdom, don't we?
We have a chance to go through Israel, and you kind of wonder why she's not shown somewhere.
I guess I would have to say that's a very good question, and if Israel was in chapter 21 somewhere, I'd say, well, there's the answer. But it's not.
Yeah.
So maybe it's just that God is looking at this from the standpoint of the church, and the gospel church and what she goes through and where her ultimate destiny mm-hmm. will be. Rather than earthly Israel, he's only thinking in terms of spiritual Israel. But certainly the prophecies flesh out the other part of it. Mm-hmm. That's a good question. What was your other one?
Well, the other one... You know, of all that's been said, you know, because this thousand-year thing is always an issue, but I always wanted to ask this to somebody. Why does it really matter the length of time? You know, when we pinpoint the Lord's return and we pinpoint the function of the church, now going through Revelation, we see the fact that we know the saints are going to be raised, we realize that Satan has to be bound, we realize the basic structure of what has to happen in order for the kingdom to be complete. And why is it so significant or important, whether it's 1,000 years or 1,500 or 986 or 300, you know, why is it so important?
Very good question. Why has it caused so much commotion?
Yeah.
My opinion is that the reason it has is because in the minds of some brethren, going back some decades now, when they heard, they knew that some brethren changed their opinion, and there were brethren that changed their opinion. I mean, I happen to know personally, firsthand, Brother Pollock changed his opinion on this question. Because I asked him when I was a young man, interested in the truth, you know, his views, and he said, you know, I believe the 1,000 years had begun, and then I changed my opinion on this question. And when he, as a very prominent leader, and others aggregated around him with this view, seemed to change a position, other brethren were apprehensive and said, you're discarding some of the testimony of the seventh messenger that ties into the concept of the Lord's return, and therefore you're weakening the whole basis of our prophetic structure. That argument was entirely overblown, in my opinion. But it is true that there are some brethren that feel that the 1,000 years is future, that link that together with a general, disinclination to view with interest time prophecies and the prophetic testimonies about where we are. And notice, you know, we're all creatures that make pattern recognition. That's why we can see things and understand. We recognize that pattern. We say, that pattern, I remember that. That's going in the direction of the Lord that return and all this stuff. And so they raise an alarm that's overblown. What they should have recognized better, I think, is reprint Article 2947 or whatever it is, that where Brother Russell gives both views. And then to realize, okay, what you're doing is saying you're changing from this horn of the dilemma to this horn of the dilemma. And maybe let it go at that. And I think that would be a more correct opinion. As it is today, you bear with me as I express my own opinion on the subject, because I'm just like Brother Pollock. I always believed the 1,000 years had begun, and now I don't. But the difference is, I now think that both horns of the dilemma that Brother Russell faced and could not resolve by his own admission are now resolved, not by saying which is right and which is wrong. It's not a choice. They both turn out to be correct. If the seventh millennium is still future, then it synchronizes with the other view. But you can go way back to Miller's day. Miller believed the Lord would return in 1843. Did he believe in the venerable tradition? Yes. The Lord's return would be at the end of 6,000. Brother Russell picked his whole prophetic package up from Barber, he says so, in 1 year in 1876. And that's what we have today. And inbred in that is an assumption that's wrong. The wrong assumption is that 6,000 years do not trigger the beginning, but rather the end of the harvest. Everything else does. Your husband always used to ask me, if you do that, how do you figure the Jubilees? And I could never answer him. Now I could answer him. But now I'd rather hear his answer. No, I think it's an unfortunate result of a circumstance. Yeah.
Well, just one comment on that, though. When we had a discussion with somebody else, that I think my impression is from the New Testament in particular, the Lord's focus, if he wants you to know something, he's very specific about understanding when the Lord returns. So it seems that, you know, that he gives us that as the point of reference that, yes, I want you to know when I return, if you're living at that time, it's important.
Yes.
So if we feel we know that, then...
That should be satisfactory. That should be the core and the bulk of our prophetic testimony. I think you're right. For a long time, for many years before I had a different opinion, I recognized that in the prophecies of Daniel, time prophecy, the one time prophecy stands head and shoulders above every other one in Scripture is the 1260 days. It's twice in Daniel. It's five times in Revelation. You can't get at the back. That's the foundation. From that springs the 1290 and the 1335 that take you to the Lord's return. That's the foundation we've got for the Lord's return prophetically. And that, by the way, was why Brother Barber thought the Lord would return in 1873, changed to 1874, because of 1335. After that, he took everything else and bent it to fit that. He says, well, I've got to figure out some way for the times of the Gentiles to mesh with this, because Miller did, so I got it. I got to figure out some way for the Jubilees. I got to figure out some way for the 6,000 years. And he did. He found a way. But he started with the foundation of 1335. And everything else was ready. And that's why I would suggest that now that we have a clearer view of the time, we see how all these fragments of prophecy all do fit very nicely, just not quite the same way. But they all testify very, very nicely. But now we don't have to bend. Now they just flow. Well, Jonathan, I've gone over even the clock that I like.
Okay.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Brother David, do you have a...